Hello, fellow nerds, and welcome to another episode of the Modern Health Nerd Podcast's May Mushroom Month, where this month we're bringing you fascinating conversations with the movers, shakers, and innovators in food, health, and mushrooms. Today I'm talking with Matt Hall, who's the owner and founder of Midnight Harvest Mushroom Farm in Michigan. I actually met Matt on Clubhouse during a conversation that was supposed to be about food innovations but quickly turned to all things mushrooms, and I was really fascinated by the fact that he has this mushroom farm and that he is working on growing mushrooms. And I wanted to have him on the podcast to share what he's doing, to share some of his mushroom growing expertise, and to just generally chat about the amazing nature of all things fungi. Matt actually turned to mushroom farming because he found it to be something that he could do consistently and sustainably in the climate of Michigan, where it's not as easy to grow some other foods. Matt is really looking at the intersection of science and farming to bring about both sustainable production and innovation in the mushroom space. I was really blown away by some of the stuff that we dug into in this episode. We touch on everything from how they grow their mushrooms to their experiments with cultivating the morel, which apparently is quite hard to do. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your mushroom-loving friends. And give us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform, and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. If you want more information and insights and just general nerdity like this, you can visit modernhealthnerd.com/news and sign up there for my newsletter and to follow when I post on my blog. Now, my conversation with Matt Hall of Midnight Harvest Mushroom Farm. Well, Matt, welcome to the podcast. I am excited to have you here on my May Mushroom Month.
Excited to be here. Thank you.
Alliteration aside, actually, it's a little bit more of alliteration because you're Matt and you're from Midnight Harvest. I read your story a little bit on your website and your background, and I thought it was really interesting. So why don't you break down your unique trajectory from where you started to becoming a mushroom farmer?
I was in the marine mammal field, and I was one of those teens and then young adults who wanted to train dolphins. Who doesn't to be in that field? And so when I was in my first 2 years of college, I got to go on an internship at Disney and start working with dolphins and manatees for 6 months. And that was my intro to what I thought would be my forever career. And I moved home and just worked in the restaurant scene for a long time. I've been in the restaurant scene since I was 16, and now I'm 37. So I ended up almost going into that field. I moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan, about 2.5 hours south, and I was interviewing for a job for the government. I would have been working with a company called the SAIC. They train marine mammals for the Navy. And we were on our first initial call, and it was, do you want to move down and train dolphins at night in the Georgia area? And it would have been at Kings Bay, Georgia, Naval Air Base, training dolphins to protect our water borders. But at that time, while in Grand Rapids working for a restaurant, I got hooked on the idea of growing my own food. I mean, it was like a light bulb went off. And I was like, what do you mean I can grow everything? And all the documentaries were coming out about plant-based diet. And that was just hitting the market. I mean, I think it was like Forks Over Knives had just released while I was in Grand Rapids, and watching these compelling movement towards, well, I love growing plants. I think that's amazing. And here's this argument for like a plant-based space. And I'm like, okay, this seemed to be where I wanted to go. Because the dolphin thing was fun, but I'd rather have a dog. So I ended up turning that down. moving home, wanting to start a farm. And that was in 2013. I did a little stage with an actual farmer, like a field farmer. He had 5 acres at the time, and got my toes dipped into it. And then still working for the restaurants. But how do you become a farmer in Northern Michigan without the capital, the acreage, the normal farmer who grows tomatoes kind of deal? I think that was, how do I differentiate? And Paul Stamets, I got his TED talk, and that was like, okay, he's a mycologist from the Pacific Northwest. It was really cool, all the topics he was speaking to. So it was kind of really fun, faceted in the idea that like, you can grow, you can do more than just food. That's what makes you money, of course. And then you move from there. And then actually radical mycology, Peter McCoy came around Traverse City and he was having like a mushroom seminar, went to that. It was really informative. It was very cool. He asked a really good question though, in the idea of who's here to learn about mushrooms and how they can help us and how they can benefit and enrich our lives. And yeah, everyone raised their hand and I was like, okay, then who's here to make money? And I was like, oh yeah, me, you know, like, cause if you make money, you can do the other thing. You can do the other thing, but you still got to somehow. So I wanted to do both. And so I thought about how do I blend my now food growing, wanting to grow food passion with how do I make a business out of that in Northern Michigan? And sure enough, mushrooms were just hit. And I've done all the crazy things that everyone thought as far as mushrooms are concerned, when it comes to where you start with mushrooms, from the smallest scale greenhouse in my basement to now we're at a fully controlled room. So it's come a long way. So that's kind of the journey, but it was, and I use it every day, as far as like when my dolphin experience and training marine mammals, I use it every day. Mushrooms don't talk to us, you know, so you give them a control or you give them a new way of doing things, or you have to be really insightful about them. What are they telling you? What are they doing? How do they respond when you do control X or control Y or control Z? And is that the right direction? And so that's led me a lot of the way. A lot of the operant conditioning and psychology we use from dolphin training and dog training is used in mushroom growing. And I think it could be used better in a lot of plant life, as opposed to you can have all the equipment you want. That's only going to tell you what's there. It's not going to tell you what's happening or what it needs. You really have to pay attention. So I still use the training, but that's where I'm at today with mushrooms. That's how I got into it.
I love it. It's a really interesting trajectory. You don't expect it. And I love these unique backstories. It's one of the greatest things about having this podcast, being able to meet people like you that are doing interesting things and have such great backgrounds and stories to share. So it sounds like you are really into some of the science and also the experimentation of growing mushrooms. I saw also on your website and on your blog that you are attempting to do some science of your own. So can you just share what got you more into that side of things with mushrooms?
I think because, I mean, that, yeah, I love the science of mushrooms. I mean, it just enthralls me. When high school, I was in AP Chem and always had a chemistry background and always enjoyed science in general growing up. I was definitely that person or that kid who parents would get me an electric car and I would take it apart just to look at the engine, just to look at that little motor and be like, whoa, magnets. so magnets still, I still love magnetism. But when it comes to like what we're working on, I think as a farmer, you go, or as someone who's doing something, imagine if you're in this space and you have this ability to change, you know, potentially go down a road that would be groundbreaking. Why wouldn't you? And with the morel, like we've been working on the morel for 6 years, and it's only until March of 2020 that we actually were able to grow the morel on a petri dish. We were able to grow, then repeat that on a larger tissue culture container in a sterile process, which had never been done before. So most morels never been cultivated in a sterile setting. So I thought it was just interesting that as far as a farm is concerned, we could try this. I think it'd be fun. And if we hit the jackpot, wow, as opposed to, and I like to be different. I like to do something somebody's like really not doing. I enjoy that space. When somebody grows a tomato and everybody knows how to grow a tomato, or they have their ways of growing a tomato. That's what I love about mushroom farming. It's pretty unique and uncommon and gives me a space I can enjoy. And then with the morel, there's so much science, and we're blending sciences, and we're blending things that I know about every facet of growing something and turning it into something. And if here in two weeks to 2 months, so who knows how long it'll take me to get that full morel that it's indoor. For me, it's worth it because I love it. But we do make a strategic move. We don't focus on it. It's not the, from a business standpoint, we're like 95 shiitake, maitake production and 5% morel. We don't go after it with, you know, just going after it. We have to be smart about it. So, because otherwise it'll drain your bank account. Research doesn't pay for itself here. You know, I don't have grant money. I don't have investors. So that I have to be careful about, but it allows me to also take my time with it and to not speed it up. And I think that, you know, a lot of the times, if you have all the capital in the world, you can make a lot of mistakes. And I think it was, he's a really good speaker. He had the movie, I Am Not Your Guru, Tony Robbins, who, you know, when you're have the least amount of resources, you are most resourceful. And with that, that's how we run the research. You know, we don't have a lot of, but I just love it that much. I love the science of it and I love tackling it, and who knows what we'll tackle next.
So what got you into doing the shiitake and the maitake? It sounds like exclusively right now as your two big mushrooms to grow. What do you like about them?
As far as shiitake is concerned, it's just market demand. I enjoy shiitake because it's just a level above. If you see oyster mushrooms can be pasteurized or sterilized. They are so fast that really anybody can do an oyster mushroom. It's pretty easy. Shiitake isn't that way. It takes like 2 months. It takes a bit of a process. So when you're positioning yourself in the market of what you're going to grow as a farmer, you know, are you going to grow what everyone else has, or are you going to grow what only you can maybe do through a lot of effort? And I think that someone who's going to grow, you know, this type of cherry, is it priced out better for you? Is it harder? Can you perfect it? Then do that one. And is there a good demand for it? You know, shiitake is coming up in the market. It is probably surpassing. Gourmet mushrooms are just going crazy right now. It's a decentralized system. We don't have a lot of big, huge mushroom farms. I was talking to a guy in Ireland a few months ago. They're centralized. There's just big mushroom farms everywhere and they're gourmet. So they don't really have what the United States has in that respect, which I think is kind of unique. With maitake, it was market demand. I had people who reached out, wanted me to do it. And I said, okay, it'll take me almost 4 months, 3 to 4 months to even get it here to where we're growing it every week. And I still had a month of testing of looking at my processes, looking at how the maitake forms, so same process of the morel. We look at what do we need to do to perfect this mushroom, and we have to pay attention to it. We don't have all the science, we don't have the computers, we don't have the testers. We have pure eyesight and intuition. And okay, I think this is what's happening. If we do this on this many, and if it repeats itself, then we're good. If it doesn't, move in the other direction. But we are actually backtracking maitake. We're taking it away. I have so much demand for shiitake that I'd love to do maitake, but it does need its own grow room. It actually would be preferred in its own setting without shiitake for rotation. Not for any, they can grow together fine, but I would just need a bigger facility to pay attention to it better. So we're actually going full shiitake. I'll be missing my maitake pictures. I love watching them grow.
I didn't realize that the gourmet mushroom was growing that much in the market. I know, I mean, being in the plant-based space, which we will touch back on later since you mentioned forks over knives, that's what got me going from junk food vegan to whole food plant-based. So I definitely want to come back to that. So being in the plant-based space, I see mushrooms coming up as, in the vegan space, they've been big as a bacon substitute and a meat substitute for decades and decades. But I see them now coming as the basis for plant-based products. But apparently they're also growing in popularity elsewhere. I mean, being in shiitake and maitake for now, you do have mushrooms that have beneficial properties as well as being tasty. So you said there's a lot of like gourmet demand for the shiitake, and there were some people asking about the maitake, but why is it that people are getting more interested in these mushrooms when for so long in the US it's pretty much been button mushrooms, when around the rest of, you know, the rest of the world, particularly in Asia, it's been very diverse from the start?
The United States only, I think the statistics is that we consume 1% of the entire mushroom market. And the Chinese have almost 85% of the growing market. So they've been doing it forever. They believe in plant-based and it's part of their culture and heritage, which I think is amazing. You know, they would rather probably drink a mushroom tea tonic than, you know, go for the ibuprofen or go for the Benadryl, who knows. It's interesting to see the trend and why it's going that way. I wonder if it has to do a lot more with access, because before 20 years ago, where did you get your mushrooms from? The grocery store. I mean, it's probably rare. You're not going to grow them. You didn't have the sterile capacity. You didn't have the resources. And it's interesting seeing what's popping up as a grower. They all kind of go in a few ways. Some of the big growers like North Spore, Main Cap and Stem were growers, and then they turned into suppliers. So I buy spawn from them. They stopped growing mushrooms entirely. So they're supplying the mushroom industry. And I think as more access like those kind of things come up, it gives a greater market access and greater chance to people to grow them. So now you can go in your grocery store and yeah, there's White Button, there's Portobello, there's, you know, Enoki, the usual three suspects. And now there's this gourmet mushroom that's been probably grown and picked that week, that's super fresh, that's not dehydrated, that a lot of people don't know that, like, the differences between the two productions. They're just looking at a very tasty mushroom, and shiitakes are very tasty. I mean, I think when you go to a restaurant, you probably have a shiitake, but when you buy them at home, you probably buy White Button. But now you have the option of having a wonderful shiitake on your menu at home from the grocery store, as opposed to it's just a fancy night out and, ooh, they have shiitakes. So I think it's just come in education, but I know there's a lot of prominent people in the plant-based space and how they didn't know about the mushroom market. And I go, oh, this is interesting, because for me, that's my world. But I think that, you know, to a degree, the mushroom people need to get out of their world and into other worlds to spread that education. And crazy moment I had the other night, on Clubhouse, I got to chat with Dane Cook for like 30 minutes. And we were talking about mushrooms. And I go, well, here's this moment that, like, I'm the mushroom guy talking to a guy about mushrooms. And I think that's kind of cool, because sometimes we like to be in the same room as everyone else. We're all mushroom cultivators. You're preaching to the choir. So you got to get out there and educate. And I think it's coming with education and access to these things, and it's grown considerably, and people who are trying to grow them have grown considerably. There's mushroom farms popping up every week. Everyone's attempting a different tech, a new tech, you know, or different techniques, and I wish them the best. You know, it's a tough world. We work in sterile environments. So something that from who's not somebody from like a non-educational background, or from a non-technical background, it was a learning lesson. It was a learning curve. But I think coming to why is it growing? Access, people being interested in their food again, which is really nice. We're going away from the frozen dinners nights. We're going, you know, if you're looking at the package delivery meals, we get Purple Carrot, which is a entirely plant-based box. And they're great. And they send us oyster mushrooms. So they're incorporating. So bigger companies know of it. And I think it'll come along. It's amazing to think it's still an infancy around the market. But I have nothing but, I sell out every week.
That's amazing. Yeah, I must admit that I didn't really start getting into the more gourmet mushrooms myself until I started going to our local farmers market, where we have somebody who has a mushroom farm here. And I think the thing that really got me and like sucked me in were the pink oyster mushrooms at first, just because they were so pretty. I was like, they're pretty, I want them. And then I started to get into that. So speaking of education, since you are my star mushroom grower for Mushroom Month, could you explain a little bit about your growing process for people who aren't familiar with what it takes to grow mushrooms in the kind of environment that you're using?
It's literally like clinical lab meets a farm. It's a very interesting hybrid. You know, one point you're mixing substrate, and all the mushrooms we grow, like maitake and shiitake, grow on hardwood. They are designed in nature to take down lignin and other big like polymers like hemicellulose and cellulose. I mean, they enzyme powerhouses that when a tree falls over, that's what they're eating. So we give them hardwood. We supplement that hardwood with typically most growers. The big popular one online is like soybean hulls. That's for a nitrogen, like a soy content. I use wheat bran. It depends on the thing you really have to choose there is where you're getting it from. Are you shipping it in or are you getting it locally? Ideally, you'll get it locally. And hopefully the farm might be locally. That's pretty rare. So we mix a particular mix and we get it ready. We wet it. I call it taking a bath. We don't use much water in mushroom production because imagine what it takes to grow, a pound of tomatoes and how long it takes. And it's a long time. It's a lot of water. And for mushrooms, we only have to water it once right before we sterilize them. And then that's what happens when things change, because it's very messy up until we sterilize them. And after we sterilize them, it's very clean. It's clean to a point of no mold, no bacteria, no particles that we don't know about. And we put them in a specialized bag that has a micron filter on it. And the micron filter will filter out everything but the air we want to go inside the bag. Or in this case, for mushrooms, they actually do produce carbon dioxide. So they respire just like we do. They take in oxygen and they breathe out carbon dioxide. So that's pretty unique for mushrooms. So my parts per million in a room are like 1200 at all times. And if you think about outdoor CO2 levels, we're coming up at like 400 parts per million as far as the world's concerned. And so we're like three times the level of outside most of the time. But that's no difference than like 12 people standing in the same room breathing non-vented air. So you're all just going to be mushrooms. So then once they're in the bag, they stay in the bag and they're sterilized. So this is the unique part that comes along. Some places sterilize with pressurized heat using an autoclave or an exposed or a retort. I actually use an atmospheric steam sterilizer, which just means we are not using pressure at all because pressure can be dangerous. We just steam for a long period of time and about 25 hours. And then once they're cleaned, basically with steam, we take them in front of a flow hood. That flow hood provides sterile air, just like a flow hood, like you would have in like a microbiology lab. And we can inoculate them with whatever spawn or whatever type of mushroom we want. And so it's really cool that you can actually use pretty much interchangeably any, like the media you're using can be any mushroom you want. I'm growing different mushrooms on the same substrate to say, which is amazing. Like you don't have to change it up. They all kind of love the same lunch. With shiitake, they'll go into incubation. We seal it up. They're completely sterile inside the bags along with their spawn and along with their, we don't use spores. We use a tissue culture and they'll grow out basically. They'll then begin to colonize the substrate and they're actually eating it. They're actually turning the wood material into their biomass, into their mycelium. And eventually with like shiitake, it goes all white and then it blisters and then it goes all brown. And it's a unique process. With maitake, it stays white the entire time. Doesn't do the browning process. So they do have the uniqueness as they grow. And after about 8 weeks with shiitake, to fruit them, we just flip them upside down. You can literally give them a little shock, a little gravity shock, and that will let the mushrooms know. It's almost like, I don't think everyone's ever actually definitively explained what is happening that I've seen. And I don't want to throw out a theory out there that would be wrong. Or that would be incorrect based on no science at all. That just works. So you flip them upside down, it just works. Is there a science happening? Probably, but one that I've never explored definitively. And then after that, we bring them out of the bag and they go into a fruiting room. Now we're dirty again. Now we're not sterile. Now we're in a room that's like 80 to 85% humidity. And with the lights are on, mushrooms don't just grow in the dark. In fact, they benefit from light. Shiitakes will be pale, albino, if you don't provide light. And maitakes will stay in like a gray form if you don't provide light. One of the health benefits of mushrooms that when they're exposed to sunlight, they actually, just like us, when they're exposed to sunlight, they do create vitamin D in their epidermis, in their skin tissues. It's the same reaction. So it's unique in that you can expose mushrooms to sunlight. They'll create vitamin D. Within about 5 days, we can actually eat that mushroom that's loaded in vitamin D now. And vitamin D is thermal stable. So you can cook it in a pan. You're not going to cook it out. Vitamins are largely thermal stable. They really don't like a lot of light. That's the weird part. And then from there, we just harvest them. The blocks, this mass that we create, can actually keep growing mushrooms for years. We throw them in the backyard or in the back forest, and you'll go back there during fall when a ton of rains come along, and you'll just have thousands of shiitakes. And yes, it smells like a lot of mushrooms in my backyard. So that's a little bit of the process. It's kind of, it's unique in the idea. One moment where we're mixing like a farmer would, I don't want to call it dirty, but it's messy and it doesn't need to be sterile. And then we sterilize. Now we're clean. Now we're very careful. The gloves are on. The isopropyl alcohol is out. We're very aware of our movements. And then they're sealed. And then for 8 weeks, they sit on a shelf. You can literally forget about them. And they don't need anything. They're microclimates. It's amazing. You know, imagine, you know, a lot of these growers who have huge indoor farms, some of their problems can be very systemic. If it's in, it's in. It's a problem for everything. Whereas mushrooms, you can isolate and not waste and not have to throw out a ton of stuff or not lose a lot of time. But being that it's sterile, you have to be very careful. But that comes with time. And then it goes back to being not dirty, but not sterile. Mushrooms are easy to clean. We have a cleaning process. And as long as you're on top of that. And the cool thing being that when it comes to plant safety, I would say, or safety of anything, most people, I went to a trainer meeting, and the idea that a lot of pathogens that you hear about lettuces come from wash water or where the lettuce was in the field. And the reason it's not good is because that lettuce may never be cooked. And so you aren't going to cook off the pathogen. It's going to be there. So, well, shiitake is kind of nice because we don't use any wash water. We don't have to wash them. We just clip them from the block. And we also cook them. So it's a double. It's a very safe aspect of growing a food commodity, which is really nice. Because in food, you got to be aware that you're growing food for the public good, and stuff can happen. So that's a little off tangent of how they grow, but it's a process. Sorry.
No, I think it's really interesting. I'm the modern health nerd for a reason. I just love all the nerdy stuff. So you have this process that you use, and you're growing these mushrooms, which are now growing in popularity because we have more people who are discovering them around the world and not just in Asia. And I just kind of wanted to tie it back to the plant-based space because, as I mentioned, mushrooms are super hot in the plant-based space right now. I mean, as an ingredient in other products, but you mentioned that you guys get purple carrot. You mentioned forks over knives. Where do you stand on the plant-based spectrum yourself?
We're plant-based. You know, if we go out, I'll be honest, if we go out to a restaurant, I'm not going to try and change their menu to a large degree. We'll take out the large protein, but we focus on plant-based. We almost specifically go to restaurants. We don't have to worry about that anymore. Because some places you go and you look at their menu and you're just going, I don't want to tell the chef, please whip me up something special. Because I respect them and I've been in the industry. And so we go, you know, we are definitely plant-based at home, like 100%, except for our dog. We haven't converted him yet. So we're plant-based, Whole Foods. We love vegetables, you know, and the forks over knives was just a game changer. In the Game Changer movie, that was amazing. That was a great aspect of it. And so when people, I get a lot of questions about that from like my family, like, why are you that way? And I go, well, I'll eat a 1 pound salad and you eat a 1 pound burger and let's run a mile. Who's going to last longer? And I really tie it into more of the notion of like, I mean, I can tie it into a lot of things. I really could. I mean, I think if you're looking at factory farming, if you're looking at the waste streams, if you're looking at the economic or the impact of what it has on this earth and what it's happening. Yeah. Oh yeah. All there. But I like to dial it down to a more of a personal level. So it's not like a fight between us or a difference of opinions immediately. I just feel better eating plants. I feel way better eating plants any day of the week. And if I have animal protein, it just does a number on my system now and I can feel it. So it's all those things, and it's one simple thing also. And, you know, I think that plant-based space is just like, it's unreal. And it's nice to see people like getting on board, but just like with mushrooms, it takes education.
What got you to make the mostly a complete transition? What really prompted you? Was it movies like Forks Over Knives and Game Changers, or was it something larger than that?
Wasn't really anything. No, it was, I was actually when in Grand Rapids, when I went pescatarian and, you know, was still okay with fish. And oh man, after Seaspiracy came out, that was a unique one. And I'm going, oh, you know, like we were plant-based and we would tolerate fish. And then we're like, oh, maybe we should really think about this. And you don't need to give me statistics after you show me how they fish farm or how they do all that. I mean, I just need the imagery. And okay, you know, throw any statistics around it, just look at that. And that's not what we should be doing. I mean, I think there's a difference between somebody who wants to go fish in their own lake and catch one salmon or one trout, I get it, to netting and dredging the ocean of everything. I'm like, okay, well, it was really a long change over time. Like, okay, pescatarian, vegetarian, mainly vegetarian. If we're out and about, there was probably a fish at times. And now at home, purple carrot, we don't bring in the animal proteins. When we go out, we specifically choose places that we know will be more plant-based friendly, or we know they have dishes. Like we just went to a restaurant the other night. We know they're plant-based friendly. We know they have more than five options, as opposed to a lot of places you go, oh, here, all the way down at the bottom, this little vegetarian bowl is yours. And, you know, that's it. So it wasn't so drastic as it's been over time. And some of those movies just reinforce what you're talking about or what you naturally believe in. They can give you the stats. And I think it's great. It's interesting from a scientific aspect of like, when I talk to people, you know, that big argument of, well, you need your protein. And if they were a dear friend to me, or if I knew I could kind of mess with them a little bit, I go, which amino acid are you targeting? And they would kind of go, what do you mean amino acid? I go, okay, well, step one, you don't know what I'm talking about when you say protein. You know, for me, it comes down to a really scientific aspect. It's amazing to think that humans right now, we're in these lanes because of grocery stores. We're in these lanes because of what we have access to. And if we think about the human aspect of, yeah, we don't make, I think it's 11 proteins. We have to eat them. That's how our body's working. They're synthetically putting it together, or that we need to get them because our body doesn't put them together. And I go, man, but like, imagine all the things you buy at the grocery store are always the same thing. And maybe there's like a plant out there that we have never tested that has an amino acid or a protein that would wow us, that would go, whoa, like our bodies would be like, hello. And I think that's something that's interesting about like, the idea of what we know and what we don't know. We know a lot as humans, but maybe that dandelion out there probably has a protein inside of it that if you ate it raw, it would do this. But we've been treat dandelions as weeds. And so it's really kind of interesting. It's eye-opening when you get into that space. I think but you have to want to be in that space. You have to want to learn more about your genome and why maybe plant-based is better for us. And looking at the medical, but that's a big hill to climb with some people.
And it's funny that people would ask you, of all people, where you get your protein, since mushrooms have a pretty decent amount of protein by weight. I mean, when I want a little extra protein hit, I throw some mushrooms in something. And like you said, people aren't as aware of this. They're just like, oh, mushrooms, let's get a pizza.
Yeah, totally. That's where the mushroom, that's what, luckily, thank you for pizza that introduced the mushroom. Yeah, protein is interesting. You know, I enjoy it. And the idea that like with mushrooms, you know, especially with like the morel, I've gone through a lot of self-research and a lot of self-reflecting, because if you get it wrong, you have to reevaluate or you can give up. So if you come up with a theory and it doesn't work, okay, you give up or you keep looking for the answers. And holy cow, I've been down some rabbit holes. But I found greater truth in those holes. And also to, you know, listen more carefully to what I'm hearing when it comes to statistics, when it comes to news, when it comes to information that's being passed across. But it's always eye-opening going, man, like this is a whole world I don't understand sometimes. And I don't even know if I can should even speak on it sometimes, because I know the tip of the, you know, I know this much, like tiny amount, to someone who's a protein expert, and I would love to hear them and just go, whoa, okay, now I know more truth. And to a degree, you know, not that I understood it, but
I think you would get it. You sound like you're into the science. If you haven't read stuff like T. Colin Campbell's Whole or his Future of Nutrition, those are both interesting. Whole is a really good book. It's about how, like, everything we don't know about food and how food works together, like, in a holistic way. It's a really interesting book if you like the nerdy science. Well, we've covered a lot of ground here, and we're kind of getting closer to the end here and to the wrap up, but I wanted to ask a couple of questions really briefly. One that was just kind of on my mind, and the other one that's my big wrap up question that I ask all my podcast guests. You're doing something that is unique. You're doing something that is really close to your heart. How do you feel like you're contributing with what you're doing to changing the food landscape?
I think it's going to be in a unique way, in the idea that when it comes to business and passion, there's this thing you thread of you have to be sustainable to run your business. And that requires a little bit of capitalism, but it doesn't mean you can't be philanthropic. So I would say in the food system, I'd love to show people, I'd love to expose more of how we grow mushrooms and how sustainable it is, because it's extremely sustainable. There's some things that should be changed in the mushroom aspect, but not to a degree of waste. It's just amazing. We can grow a lot of food in one space and per pound, and it can make a huge impact. And we don't have to have acres on acres. I think it's really the idea. I love the idea of showing people that you can grow your food. You can be closer to your food than you think. And it doesn't have to be all green, grassy lawns. Start a garden is simply. Two, I think about the morel and going, if we get that, if we have that moment, it provides a pretty good platform to do more with food, to democratize it a little bit more. To what can we do with it? How can we be a partner in the food space? And whether that's access, whether that's growing, where do we want to play? The morel for me is going to be like massive, and not just the idea of, okay, we broke the science, but now what can we do with it? What can we go farther? It won't be the point we rest. It'll be the point we get to work on food. And I always wanted a farm where people could come see food in action and not just be a production farm. And one of the bigger passions that I have, one of the bigger dreams for my city, even though we're kind of a foodie town, we're not really, would be to have a greenhouse that's dedicated to food, not just a cactus and to, you know, a fern. I think those are great, but be a high production greenhouse to where we're growing impact food locally that would be ran by volunteers, and that all of the food would go to pantries and or people who need it. And kind of run that kind of program. And maybe there's maybe a model out there already that I should be looking at, but I just think it'd be really cool to, what if I could fund my own food greenhouse in this city, and that food is run by volunteers who just want to be a part of the process. Plus growing plants is cool, but that food is given to the people who need it the most. And then also educational, you know, bring the kids in, bring the colleges in, bring the high schools in. It can be both. They can be part of that process. And then learn, okay, yeah, you should not grow a tomato in northern Michigan. Like, it like might not be the best spot, but you can grow carrots for days. Or you can do this type of protein, like a bush bean, which just produces tons of beans. And beans are great for protein. And, you know, that kind of connection value plus production value, I see more sustainable. And plus, I love growing food.
Well, I think that at least partly touches on my official wrap-up question, because you have a vision there. So I always ask my podcast guests at the end, if you had unlimited power and resources at your disposal, and you could bring about one change in the modern food system, what would you do? Would you do what you were just talking about, or would you do something different?
This is a tough one. Like, I don't know if I should tailor it to the food system, but once we have, if we had unlimited power and unlimited resources, I would hire the best scientists to tackle pollution, to tackle plastics, we need to break them down. Plastics are integral in our lives. I'm very aware of this. I mean, my headphones, everything behind me, probably most of my clothing, but what we're doing to the world with them is just, it's probably irreversible. I don't want to think that, but I would hire the team of the best scientists, from oil to enzyme to to science, to natural, and say, we need to get rid of this. We need to put it back in the earth naturally. And I give them a caveat. I would say, because a lot of scientists work on, and they're in labs, and they're probably working for a big company. And if they do any breakthrough, the big company owns it. I mean, they're going to sign probably a big old contract saying, we own this when you figure it out. And or they're working towards a problem like, oh, we're a huge conglomerate who has a problem with our corn and it's being eaten up by this mold. So can you guys figure a pesticide out? I mean, that's usually what you see in a lot of labs is directional research. And that's it's for money. So we would say to all of our scientists, if you figure this out, you'll get a retirement check, like one that you never have to be a scientist again. Because collectively, if you guys figure out pollution and trash, you should retire. That's a gift. You shouldn't have to go look for another job. You shouldn't have to worry about grant money in your lab running, because that's a lot of them looking for grants, looking for investors, looking to hopefully make my year. And we would hire that team to get that job done, to give us a solution to the trash that we're accumulating in the land and the oceans and from food production and from any kind of thing. So it's not necessarily food-based, I understand, but that would be my infinite. If we had all the money, I'd hire the team to figure that out. And I would say, by the way, the faster you do this, the faster you retire.
And you never know, mushrooms might figure into that. There's a lot of talk about what they can digest and what they can eat and clean up. So you never know. It might all come full circle if you were able to do that. So for people listening who are interested in connecting with you, I know you're active on Clubhouse. Where else can they find you and where can they find out more about what you're doing?
Instagram is Midnight Harvest and so is Facebook. And then I believe on LinkedIn, I'm just under Matthew Hall. I don't have a page for my business there. It's just me personally. Those are the best ways. I have my website, which is midnight-harvest.com, and that's got all the fun stuff on it. Just what we work on. I updated it a little bit here and there. I'm pretty bad at the website, but those are the places. I'm very active on Instagram, very active on LinkedIn, Clubhouse. You'll probably find me spotting around and listening here and there.
I'll put all the information in the show notes so people can get a look at that, and definitely do go get a look at his Instagram if you love beautiful pictures of mushrooms or just beautiful pictures of food and natural things. So Matt, thank you again for being on the podcast. It was really fascinating to hear you delve into what you're doing, and I really wish you all the best with, well, it's going to be a shiitake farm for now, but you never know, it might be a morel farm in the future too.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is a great, thank you.
Another big thanks to Matt for bringing his mushroom growing expertise to the Modern Health Nerd Mushroom Month. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Honestly, I enjoyed it the first time, and then going back through and editing this episode, I was blown away all over again, particularly by the mushroom growing process. It's something that, as I've learned more about mushrooms, I've wanted to do myself beyond just the kits that you can buy in the store, and maybe I'll be able to get into it someday, but who knows? If you're somebody who has tried it already, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at sam@modernhealthnerd.com and tell me all about your mushroom growing experience. I'd love to hear about it. And again, if you liked this episode, please give it a rating, give us a review, wherever you listen to podcasts, and subscribe so that you don't miss another episode. Because next week, we are wrapping up May Mushroom Month before we delve back into the plant-based space. Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Modern Health Nerd Podcast, and until next week, stay nerdy!